Blog Talk Radio.
I picture you in the sun, wondering what went wrong, and falling down on your knees, asking for sympathy, and being caught in between all you wish for and all you see, trying to find anything that you feel that you can believe in.
Well, hello and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thanks for tuning in tonight, whether you're across town or across the globe, and hopefully you're tuning in every Wednesday or certainly sometime afterwards as you listen to us from the archives at your convenience. And I want to say, as always, I appreciate your feedback and contributions to the show, so keep those emails and articles coming. And remember, you can call in and ask questions or email your questions in advance of the show. But here's what's really best. Go to Blog Talk and click on the Follow Me button on my show page so that you never miss the weekly show. You'll get reminders of who my guests are, and when life gets busy, you won't miss anything important or provocative or enlightening that my many wonderful guests provide listeners. And while you're there, please mark the show as a favorite. And as I always love to say, I want you to know how important you are to me. You are really gas in my tank, because you are. So thanks for taking the show along with you on your iPod when you're out and about, whether you're exercising or just kicking back. One listener emailed and said she listens to the show when she's soaking in a hot bubble bath with the lights dim and scented candles for ambiance. I got that picture, and I'm smiling, so thank you. And I'm glad you value what my wonderful guests have to say. And my thanks goes out to this week to Laura Kane for the use of her music, that tiny little snippet you were listening to and I was just starting to get into when it cut off, was called In the Sun. And if you like that, you can find more of her music at laurakane.com. And she spells her name a little different. It's L-O-R-A-C-A-I-N. So please go look for her. She's got some good stuff out there. And, wow, can you hardly believe it's almost Labor Day, the end of summer already. Where did the time fly? And it's going to fly tonight. As usual, when I have a double feature, tonight our double feature includes at the top of the hour John Rasmussen, and our show topic with him is Shaman's Prophecies and Work Towards Return of the Feminine. Among the things we'll be talking about are his prophecies about the fall of the masculine warrior dominance and the return of the powerful feminine for a healthy, sustainable, and peaceful world. You know, we have women who talk about this a lot, but it's really interesting to get the male perspective, so we've been looking forward to this. Then we'll mix it up a bit about an hour later with our guest Ricky Ott, author of Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Ricky's a PhD and community activist, and she's been spending a lot of time down on the Gulf of Mexico witnessing what's happening there with BP, which she'll share with us, as well as her campaign to start a movement to abolish corporate personhood, which will certainly help destroy our democracy if we don't find a way to amend the Constitution. We'll talk about how the two things are interconnected, and she has a unique perspective on all of this, having lived through the Exxon Valdez spill as a former commercial fisherman. And yes, I didn't say fisherman, I said a fisherman. That's what she calls herself. But first up is John Rasmussen, our contemporary shaman. So let me share his bio with you. John's work serves to empower individuals, partners, groups, and organizations through advanced shamanic and coaching techniques for a greater quality of life and work. He has a global private practice, and he works out of a hotel called the Post Ranch Inn, located in Big Sur, and also the Cavallo Point Lodge in Sausalito, so you're lucky if you're up in Northern California. He's close to you. He also consults for the Everyday Genius Institute. He published a book titled Dreaming Your World into Being, and maintains an active website at dreamingintobeing.com. John began his own shamanic training at an early age through study and practice of a wide variety of scientific, spiritual, and healing modalities and near-death experiences. Later, he began to own his gifts as a contemporary shaman when he was initiated by a Native American medicine woman. Medicine woman, I said. And soon after, it became a part of a unique lineage of Peruvian shaman known as the Cuero. After 500 years of isolation in their villages high in the Andes, the Cuero, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, their prophecies instructed their students to initiate all who were being called to help heal the world and usher in the return of the feminine-based worldviews and a way of living that's fully conscious, healthy, sustainable, and peaceful. Thousands of years of the masculine warrior-dominated myths and lifestyles that were spread around the world have led to a buildup of wounding in the souls of women and men and all of nature. John and fellow shaman of all modalities are eager to heal the wounds and help humanity to learn to live in harmony with the untamable feminine. John and his wife Gina have been playing together like children in a big sandbox for over 18 years now, and they live in Monterey, California. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. I'm really very honored to be here with you and your listeners, and thank you for all your work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Well, likewise. And, you know, we were sort of kidding around before the show started that, you know, some people, you know, might be a little surprised to hear that there are contemporary shaman. You know, they get this idea of, you know, a shaman is this, you know, dark-skinned guy down in Peru or somebody in the Amazon with a bone through his nose. Why don't you, you know, maybe just, I know this is really simple and elementary, but just sort of, you know, give us an idea of how you came to this, and especially your teachers were these very people that unfortunately sometimes those of, you know, those in the West, you know, maybe they marginalize a bit too much, you know, because, you know, they don't look at them as being educated in the West, and I think they're probably really missing a really important part of the picture.
Yes, I think, you know, these cultures are actually very sophisticated. I mean, these are the cultures that built cities in the Andes like Machu Picchu and others, you know, so they're a primary culture, but very, very sophisticated. And, you know, my definition of shaman is, you know, the person in the village who can see things, figure things out, dialogue with nature in such a way that they can then bring useful, helpful information and techniques and such back to the village to improve the quality of life. So, you know, typically out of a village of 100, there was one shaman. And the only difference now is that we live in villages of 20 million. So there's really a lot more shamans. It's just that we've forgotten, you know, to recognize those people, you might say. And the indigenous, fortunately, indigenous cultures that were able to remain, you know, somewhat isolated have held on to that and now are eagerly returning it back to us so that we can embrace it again, recognize it and use it, you know.
Well, we're lucky that we haven't totally lost that sacred knowledge, especially how we're decimating these cultures and their rainforests. And, you know, just their, you know, the world in which they live, I would imagine it's probably a struggle for them to hold on to their way of life to help us save ourselves with their knowledge.
Truly, yes. It's been difficult for most cultures. And as a result, many of them, you know, have had to hold a lot of their wisdom and their teachings very close and very secretive. And that's the image that most of us, you know, kind of grew up with is, you know, there's these people off in reservations or remote jungle villages that you have to, you know, somehow get to and be accepted. And that was true for a long time and probably rightfully so. Probably was a very good idea. And in fact, my Caro teachers from Peru, what sort of makes them somewhat unique is that they actually consciously chose to isolate themselves at 18,000 feet in the Andes for 500 years to make it a little easier to hold on to the real comprehensive, you know, knowledge. And, you know, it was part of their prophecy that they ended up doing this, and then it's been part of their prophecy that they've now returned from that isolation and have eagerly begun to share and spread as much of their knowledge as they can now to those of us who are called to do the
work. Well, John, what's a contemporary shaman, I mean, in just plain terms, what can they help individuals with? What can they help sort of our, how can they affect our global consciousness, or can they? I mean, is that really the ultimate aim?
Yes, it actually is. According to their prophecies, we are going through a shift in consciousness, right at this time, that's critical, that's very important for really the survival of our species and the planet. And the Kiro call is the Pachacuti, the world turning right side up again, basically is what that means. And so the training that we've gone through with them as contemporary shamans and people from other modalities as well, or learned from other tribes, if you will, is about helping individuals kind of remember, if you will, who we really are. Remember that we've never left the garden. It was just a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very small story that got spread all over the world. And over the years became, sort of widely accepted, even unconsciously in many ways. And so the modern shamans now, what we're doing is not only reminding, people psychologically, if you will, that, who they really are and our connection to nature and how that can, improve our quality of life and the world. But we're also able to heal, thousands of years of these wounds that have resulted from the thinking that we were separate from nature and fighting nature and fighting the feminine within us and fighting each other in order to dominate the resources or that kind of thing. So the work that we do actually goes right to that.
Well, I would imagine you were probably pretty excited to see the movie Avatar come out.
Very, yeah. No, I sit there. I kind of felt that way about The Matrix. I think that was one of the first that began to tap into the idea that we actually have the power to dream our world into being, so to speak. And then the Avatar, which of course makes this great, obvious statement to many of us about what's been happening. And what needs to be brought to consciousness. So yes, I think this is all part of that
relearning, the rethinking,
the relearning and the rethinking, absolutely, and the regaining of the myths that work and getting
right.
rid of the ones that don't.
Well, speaking of the ones that don't, were you surprised, or did you hear that the Pope came out? Because there was so much acclaim for the movie, saying that nature will never replace true religion. It just tickled me to death that it got under his skin so much. That this was really speaking to the people.
Absolutely, and you actually make a really important point about that, because over the last 10 years that I've really been doing this work in the trenches, so to speak, with people not unlike the Pope that are can't help but feel this shift and really question what they've been doing. And of course, I like to say that this warrior masculine is, in many many ways would be kind of going out kicking and screaming,
Right.
As they lose control again. And so that's that's an example of that this nobody can avoid this getting under their skin at this point.
Well, and I would imagine if you're somebody like the Pope or really invested in these ideas that exclude religion, exclude the feminine, that you must be feeling tremors under your feet right now. I would hope so anyway. Maybe that's just wishful thinking. But, I do want to ask you about your early years. But since we were talking about, the shift, I'm always curious if how do we identify that shift? And I'm wondering, this ugliness that we're seeing in our own country today with this you know, with the Ground Zero Mosque and the, you know, the world issues, you know, all of this ugliness that has us at each other's throats, and the real conservative right that would certainly reject all of these ideas. I mean, do you, are they so loud and ugly and insane now because they're feeling the shift, you think? Or is it just their nature and it does, the shift has nothing to do with it?
Well,
that's a loaded question, right?
All of the above. Yeah, no, I mean, there's no question that that's the nature. You know, the warrior masculine is based on fear. You know, you don't attack something or somebody unless you feel that you've got the potential to lose something or that they're separate from you. And so, yes, fear is really at the core of all of that. And right now, they are feeling the shift. I mean, and so it's like a dog being backed into a corner, you know, and so they become a little more ferocious as they realize that they're fighting a losing, you know, battle.
Right, right.
And so, yes, it seems that things, you know, might almost be getting worse in that regard, but the reality is it's a good sign in a way because it means that they're getting to that point of sort of desperation where something's going to have to snap, you know, internally and realize that this isn't working. And unfortunately, you know, like you mentioned, the powers that be kind of understand that divide and conquer notion too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a lot of what's going on as well, is that, you know, if you can't beat them, get them to fight themselves kind of a thing.
Right. Well, do you encounter many of these sorts of people in your practice? I mean, do they stumble onto you, or that's because, well, the reason I ask is because the second part of the question was, how do you reach those people? Can they be reached? Or like some of my other guests just say, no, we just keep moving on, and you know, and you know, we don't try to you know, make them see the light, so to speak. You know?
Yeah. No. Well, I think that is the right approach. I believe that that's how, you know, you can't force something in that way. And so, and I've been fortunate in some ways, I guess, that I've been, you know, placed into situations where a lot of my clients do sort of stumble upon me. You know, these are people that may have never read anything spiritual or really, you know, entertained the notion of any sort of alternative worldview or healing modality, and so it's not me chasing them. They show up, and they may be a little bit surprised at what, you know, they're in for, but I have the, you know, I sort of have the ability to kind of make it all feel somewhat comfortable, because there isn't any reason why it shouldn't be. And, you know, because shamanism is a very open system, it's not meant to force a viewpoint onto somebody. It's meant to just clear things away so that person can come into their power and freedom. And then hopefully by that, they no longer need to, you know, fight the warrior masculine battle.
Right.
And so it's fascinating once we get a chance to sit down and they understand that this isn't something, you know, that's against them, but that actually wants to help, that it opens up very nicely. And
well,
it's just happened
to see
people.
Jesus sitting in a circle with shaman. I think he'd be perfectly at ease, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really believe that all of those great, you know, the great ones from all traditions were essentially, you know, the shamans.
Right.
Because it's a very broad umbrella. I mean, you know, it was the first shaman might have been the person who kept the fire burning in the cave to keep her children warm, you know, something very simple when we were just living in caves, and then became the herbologists and the bone setters and figured out the cycles of the seasons when we became agrarian, and then became the storytellers and myth makers and psychologists and doctors and actors and scream and visionaries and entrepreneurs, you know. So I think
would you call
shaman
Joseph Campbell a contemporary shaman?
Joseph Campbell?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I would have to say that his work and what he did to wake people up to working with the mythic, I mean, was absolutely visionary and absolutely, shamanistic, yeah. And,
well,
and that's
gives
the
people
thing.
A scope for which a shaman can really be today.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's kind of what the way I started the conversation is that there I think there's a lot of people walking around that are shamans,
mm-hmm.
but because we didn't recognize it in grade school and begin to give them the rites and the initiation and the training
mm-hmm.
that's appropriate for that, they just kind of don't know it.
Well,
you know?
Most people don't say, well, now, do you want to be a shaman when you grow up?
Right. And instead they go sit down, be quiet, and hear some Ritalin, you know, because you're obviously
the odd
kid out, you know.
The voices you're hearing, they're, you know, here, take a pill.
Right. Stop daydreaming. You know, you didn't really hear that. I mean, and that's, unfortunately, I mean, that's been the way our system, right, has been for some time now. And that's the only reason I think that, you know, we aren't just much more aware and comfortable and having a lot more people actually, you know, comfortable calling themselves shaman. And having, you know, importantly, very importantly here, having the sort of proper training
mm-hmm.
and these energetic initiation rites that make the work safe and reliable and you know, efficient and, you know, safe for both the shaman and the client, you know, I mean.
Well, John, how did you start, how did you come to this? And when you say near-death experience, that sort of piques my curiosity. Did you actually have a near-death experience?
Yeah, before age 24, I actually had seven.
Seven?
Here's the, you know, I know
it
sounds spectacular. Yeah, I had a lot of accidents and did a lot of, but here's the thing. You know, when again, if we recognize the child who's the shaman, like they do in the indigenous cultures, you know, still today, and all of our ancestry, if you go back far enough, they would begin to let them understand and take them on journeys, and in a very gentle way, do the death rites, you know, separate their luminous body from their physical body, send them on a journey, so they could begin to map the territory, get comfortable with the notion that there's something other than the physical world and also how to navigate it and use it, you know, to again help improve the quality of life of the village or heal themselves. And, you know, because I didn't have that, being raised in suburban, you know, which is now Silicon Valley basically, I found other ways to do it unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, totally unconscious. I mean, I didn't know. I just crashed my car and my motorcycle and my, you know, this and that and got electrocuted, you know. And so, but basically each time it was going through a kind of an initiation, right? And that's the more difficult way to do it. Obviously, it's hard on the body. But it's what I think probably, I think a lot of people would find times in their life when they had very profound experiences that were a form of initiation in lieu of doing it in a more ritualistic, you know,
controlled environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that was up until a certain point in my life. And from about age 17 on, I was fascinated by, you know, every book I could get my hands on, I think, starting with Illusions by, I can't think of the name now, Jonathan, that's Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Richard Bach.
Okay.
And, you know, starting to kind of read these otherworldly works, and I got fascinated by literature, and so I began to deeply study it. And then I was traveling around the world in my tech work. I had a degree in engineering, and I was working in high tech, and I.
From engineering to shamanism, it's incredible. I'm sorry.
I think it ties in kind of interestingly because I believe a lot of shamanism is applied quantum physics. But basically, you know, we're using the dark energy and dark matter that the scientists know exists but can't measure it. But what was happening is, as I was traveling all over the world, I would seek out the medicine people everywhere I went on the weekends and the evenings, you know, because that was my real passion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really a student of that, and I would sit with them and I would learn from them, and a lot I'd be initiated by. And, you know, I really didn't know, again, really what was going on. I just was just kind of fascinated by this stuff. And then I met, you know, a woman who really recognized, I think, who I was, initiated me, I still didn't quite get it. But the real interesting part of the story, I guess, is that I was working with some healers, and one of them said that my work is to be a mediator of souls between the worlds, and I didn't understand that, what that meant. I couldn't see that as a business card type of thing. But when I met my teacher, Alberto Vialdo, who was the one who brought the Caro teachings, which was like 3 years after that person told me that, I sat down with him at a workshop, and he said, a shaman is just a mediator of souls between the worlds. And that was the real 2x4 that I needed, you know, across the head to kind of own that and recognize, oh, really, that's me? You know, I can do that? And then as I got the training and I began to really just believe it and own it, you know, then I recognized the gift that had always really been there, but I didn't think of it as such. And it just sort of went from there. As soon as I started doing the work, the results were amazing. And so you
grew into your calling.
I did. I really just sort of grew into it, but it took courage, and I think it's important for people to understand that sometimes to own your gift or your calling or practice it, you do have to take a leap. You know, I was frightened to death. I mean, I really was. I didn't think I was psychic. I didn't think I could see anything or figure out, you know, what was going on. And so every session I was just sort of like, you know, oh, God, I hope this works.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, you know, these powerful lineages that we call on and all the forces of nature come and work and make it happen. And you know, it's you kind of go, whew, wow, that's great. You know, and I asked my teacher, Alberto, who'd been doing it for 30 years, you know, do you ever not doubt that you can do this or that it works? And he said, no, that's part of working with the unknown and the unknowable. You'll always wonder, you know, you'll never get that to that place of total confidence that you've got it all figured out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so even today, I still get a little nervous before every session, even though I've done thousands and they've all worked really, you know, I still...
Am I going to be able to connect today?
Well, you know, are they going to show up and do the work? You know, are they
right.
Are my allies still... Yeah, and will I be able to say the thing that's going to help the person or do the clearing of the energy? You know, yeah, absolutely.
So now let me just get a clearer picture, because I think this might be a two-pronged thing you're doing. You're helping individuals heal their wounds, but are you also helping people develop their own abilities as contemporary shaman?
Yes. You know, again, I think that it comes in so many different forms, and so maybe not everybody's meant to be the shaman, you know, as who they are or what they do, but I certainly have a lot that come to me that end up recognizing that, that's their true calling and what have you. It's just been an interesting thing. You know, the color of my medicine sort of attracts this type of person, you might say. And so, yes, many, many people have gone on to go through the training themselves and are you know, practicing. And so that's been really, really wonderful. But you know, it's whatever the person's true nature and passion and work is that they will, you know, this will open up for them. As we say, you know, it's the old warrior masculine way of doing that is that we have to go out and find it and look for it and search. And in shamanism, we call off the search and we let it find us.
Okay.
It's much more of the more powerful feminine way.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about those warrior myths. How did the masculine warrior myth and that way of life become so dominant? I mean, were these shaman, like these Quero who taught you, did they ever operate under that sort of paradigm, or were they always operating themselves under more of a sacred feminine paradigm?
I would say the latter. I would say that they had always operated under a sacred feminine paradigm. And we're talking, you know, 5,000 to 50,000 years back that anyone can, through oral tradition, of course, because there was no written tradition, can sort of remember, you know, so to speak. But and also archaeological evidence and such that has proven this out. That, you know, and it makes sense because the only way to sustain a society or culture or civilization more than a couple of hundred years or maybe a thousand or a couple thousand, you know, is by living in the feminine, you know, the feminine-based life. You can't sustain the other. So just by virtue of the fact that they still exist, you know, and we still exist, it's sort of a testament to that this has been, I think, the real fundamental basis of our species, you know, the feminine-based approach.
Right.
You know, that only, you know, and the way the Caro describe it is that, you know, their worldview is it's the feminine that gives birth to everything. You know, the earth is creating the new species and the jungles and the volcanoes and the sun is the masculine that just bathes the earth in the light and energy that makes that possible, but certainly doesn't direct, you know, you should have a new, you know, forest over here and you better, you know, have a new species.
Right.
It's not in charge. And so that's just sort of obvious to them, and they honored that and they lived that way, and they understood that they could call on the rains and the rains would come. They could ask through ceremony and prayer and ritual, and the whole world conspired to help them enjoy their time here, you know, to enjoy this creation. And then their prophecy said 500 years ago that these half-men, half-beasts were coming with skins of steel and thunder sticks to turn their world upside down, the Pachacuti in Quechua in their language.
So are we talking about the Spanish?
This is the Spanish conquistadors, right. 500 years ago, they brought Genesis, the story, the basis of the, you know, the world's major religions, the Torah, the, you know, that mythology of origin that has now, you know, by these men on horseback, the half-men, half-beast, and their ships have been spread all over the world. And it, and the thing about myth is that it's extra psychic. It's not just in the psyche. So you could be raised by hippies in the woods or deeply steeped in a religion, but the myth kind of permeates, you know, as it gains critical mass, you might say. So everybody kind of, whether they consciously would agree with it or believe it or not, in the more subconscious mythic level of their being has this sort of, yeah, you know, Eve, you know, tasted the fruit of knowledge and got us kicked out of the garden and was born from Adam's rib. So the you know, and that was, I think, the real beginning of the, you know, that movement, you might say, of the warrior dominance, the masculine dominance, because if your approach is that creation was finished on the sixth day, so the only way to get what you need is to get it from somebody else, and you develop the weapons to do that, and you have the attitude that anything feminine is basically not so good, you know, material matter, mater, mother, you know, the body, women, you know,
right.
Feelings. If that's your belief, then killing things is not a problem. You know,
right? Yeah, and you just do it without a second thought.
Yeah, and so, you know, the pacifists who just want everyone to get along and be nice, and doesn't this just make more sense? You know, get slaughtered,
right?
Because they're not holding a sword, saying, "Wait, you know, before you kill me, let's talk." You know, or I'm gonna, you know, and that's, you know, one could argue that's kind of what's going on today with our political system.
Well, you know, as you're saying that, I'm remembering Anthony Weiner, a congressman on Keith Olbermann, saying that, you know, in Congress, the Democrats go into the chamber with library books and the Republicans go in with knives.
Touché. I watched that segment too and I thought, yes, this guy, he's speaking the language, you know, because it's true.
Yeah.
There is a point where, unfortunately, you know, you might have to stand up and you know, kick a little something and then get along, you know.
Yeah,
but
that's why I like Alan Grayson. You know, he just lays it out, and they don't know what to do when it's thrown back at them.
Right. Well,
they
right.
They get bent out of shape, you know.
Yeah, because you might not win that battle this time. And so, but nonetheless, I mean, what happened was that obviously that got spread all over. And it's obvious what's happened now, you know, with the spread of that really that one story, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of, well, and it makes you wonder, as I'm listening to you talk too, I wonder how the world might have been different if we had never had the Bible. you know, not to be offensive, but, you know, if we had never had those stories, what other stories, you know, may have taken their place and how different the world might be?
Yeah, well, that's the stories. Those are the oral traditions, you know, of all these indigenous cultures. The whole
we could have had those, if those had been the first printed book, you know, instead of what ended up as the first printed book and got spread around the world.
Right, became the global number one bestseller.
Right, right, right.
Even in motel rooms, you know, you don't
exactly.
even have to buy it.
Exactly.
But no, you're right. And yes, I believe that we might have avoided a lot of this. But since it's unsustainable anyway and it sort of ends up destroying itself, here we are. And
well, so these prophecies, do the Quero, I mean, you know, here I'm probably asking an impossible question, so, but bear with me. Do they have a sense of, I mean, how long this shift is going to take to happen or what it's going to look like? I mean, you know, or are they just realizing that it's changing? I mean, can they be more specific? You know, do they
have
any ideas?
Yeah, they have been. You know, they would read their prophecy about every 50 years, and it was just more of a farmer's almanac thing, what's happening with the weather and should we move the village, until this whole other story came about, you know. But 60 years ago when they read their prophecy, it literally said that this was about to shift, that it was all turning right side up again, and that their glacial lagoons would recede and dry up, obviously, from global warming, so they needed to come out of isolation anyway, even if they risked getting stoned to death by the, you know, the last remaining office of the Inquisition in Cusco. But what they recognize is it's happening now. Specifically, you could say that it started sometime around maybe 1992 or something, or 90, and that it would last until, you know, essentially, you know, 2012, you know.
Mm-hmm. So they're thinking that the 2012, just like everybody else is talking about that date, thinking things are going to be clearer by then, or is that when the big upheaval really happens?
Well, the way they put it, you know, because we have choice. We're still deliberate creators of, well, you know, we're creating our own experience deliberately or not, and consciously or not. So those who are trying and doing a lot to, you know, dream the world into being in this more gentle, easier way are still doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's those who are kicking and screaming, right?
Right.
And afraid, you know, like how Neanderthal must have felt when Homo sapiens, so Homo erectus showed up, you know.
Right.
Like they're kind of obsolete. So I think what they said is that there would be a tremendous amount of upheaval, unfortunately, which I think we're witnessing. I think we're seeing it. Part of that, of course, is the earth changes, because everything's conscious to shamans. There's no separation of spirit and matter. That's the old, you know, masculine feminine story. So that the earth is also participating in this, you know. So the BP oil spill, the floods, the climate change, that's all part of the feminine coming back and reasserting her power,
mm-hmm.
and dominance. And to the extent that the masculine can sort of give up and go, okay, I'm willing to get out of the way. I'm willing to, you know, instead of charging up the volcano to try and cap it, I'm willing to move aside until it does its thing, and then I'll,
mm-hmm.
you know, build sustainably on the, you know, it's on the new land. It's, you know, if we were able to do that, then this whole shift could happen without too much pain.
Oh, imagine collaboration and cooperation.
Precisely, right? And,
yes.
and being comfortable with the chaos, you know, being comfortable with the way nature works,
right.
which is messy, and
right.
not trying to control it and cut it down and put it in a box. And that's, so it takes a tremendous amount of courage is really what it is. It's really about the warrior masculine, and those of us, you know, for generations and thousands of years and lifetimes have kind of grown accustomed to that we can you know, have real courage.
Well, it sounds like it's also about letting go of our idea of control and domination. Because if you're going to sort of be at the whim, I mean, I don't like to use that word, but if you're going to accept the untamable feminine,
right,
then you almost, you know, you have to sort of let go of your illusions of control and domination. You know, you have
right.
to, I would think you have to lighten up a little bit and go with the flow.
Exactly. And again, the control and domination is only there because of fear. And so, yeah, as soon as you can have a little courage and be willing to stand in that fear, and like I said, just move aside a little bit so you don't get burned by the volcano, or
right.
then you'll be okay, you know.
Yeah.
But it is a letting go. Absolutely. We have to let go of that notion that we are. It's the hubris of the warrior masculine, you know. We'll
yeah.
figure out a way to stop that volcano.
We'll figure out a way
to stop global warming. Our technology
will dominate it. We'll dominate it. Well,
right.
we saw how good that worked with the BP oil spill, didn't we?
Exactly. And we're seeing it, in, you know, with the volcano and Iceland. I mean, this is the time where even the most hardened of those who believed that they could actually win or dominate are kind of going, oh,
yeah.
Maybe not.
Right,
and that's
right.
that's the crack. And that's, you know, and that's where the choice is to continue to try and go down that path and have a very painful experience, or to surrender, step aside, let go, and say, okay, I get it. So how, you know, what's the best way to do this?
Ask
the women. Now
yes,
what's the best way to live? You know, and swallow your pride and ego a little bit
right.
and enjoy life. I mean, it really is much better in the garden.
Well, do your teachings sort of impart any ideas what the average person can do to help them in their own life if either, A, they're afraid, you know, maybe they're in this other class of person who has been living that way and
mm-hmm.
to do things differently sounds really scary, or B, they're more of a mind like us, but they don't really know, well, you know, I'm just one person, what can I do?
Right, yeah, no, I mean, the work really does focus on the individual in finding peace within, putting down the weapons first and foremost against yourself, the judgments, the critic, the inner critic, you know, being okay being a little messy as a human, you know, being,
mm-hmm.
being okay not being perfect and experiencing some contrast and not having to have this notion that the ideal human has transcended all emotion and anger and, you know, so it's much of a shadow embracing process. So the shadow work's huge in that regard. You know, Debbie Ford.
I mean, could it even be about people who, well, let's just say, you know, I hate to, you know, to always use, you know, these people as the foil, but, you know, the conservative Christians who live
mm-hmm.
in this narrow little box,
mm-hmm.
if they just sort of open themselves up to more diversity, gee, does it really matter if gay people can get married, or, gee, does it really matter if they're Muslims living down the street? I mean,
yeah.
Is it just even that, just allowing diversity into your life?
Absolutely, absolutely. Non-judging.
Yeah.
Discernment is great. I don't want to play with those whips and chains, but you go ahead. That's the beauty of, you know, diversity. But
right.
but it's not that it's bad and, oh, you better stop. You know, that's
yeah.
the difference. That's
or
the judgment.
Or make
and
you stop, or get a law that makes
yeah.
you stop.
And see, what's really fascinating to me, Karen, is that the Christian, the teachings of Jesus, okay, who wasn't a Christian,
He was
the Christ, okay?
Right.
Like Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. You know, the bottom line is they're so closely congruent with the Caro and this feminine way of living. It's like
right.
there isn't anything. And so the real teachings there are of non-judgment, are of embracing the diversity, are of allowing yourself to get angry and, you know, when you're mad and throw the tables with the money changers and, you know, and so it's like part of the work is with that particular group when I do, you know, am sitting across from somebody who I was also raised in that tradition, you know, is to just sort of point that out, you know, to
right.
go, you know, this is no different than than what Christ was teaching. And so, you know, it's sort of like a wake up, like, oh.
Maybe help them loosen up a little bit.
A little bit. And to recognize that it's not about the preservation of the institution.
It's not,
you know, which is a warrior masculine hierarchical institution, you know, these churches that only allow men and so on and so forth. You know, so it's to kind of bring, even as a Christian, take your power back.
Right.
Take the Christ within you back and live that way.
Yeah, live Christ, not
live
the institution.
Right. So I found that really rings well. There isn't anybody that doesn't sit down, you know, no matter what their background, their religion, their beliefs, doesn't, you know, get it on some level by the time we're done. And so I think that's a big part of this work. Without it being threatening to them, it's not like you need to stop doing your religion or anything, but here's the inner work that we can do that will allow you to be more of what that religion's intent was in the first place.
Well, now, do the Quero see anything beyond 2012? I mean, or is it sort of...
Yes. They see a millennium of gold, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing as the thousand years of peace in the Christian revelation. You know, it's basically that, yes, once we go through this, either the hard way or the easy way, you know, everyone will by then have gotten it. There's really no way that you could, you know.
You could almost look at this as like the reprogramming phase, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like that word, but, you know, it's almost like the rethinking. You know, it's the rethinking, you know, that there are other ways to do this. This hasn't been working, so let's try something different.
Yeah, it's the wake-up call. It is. It's recognizing that no matter how many ways you try to stick on your way of doing it, it's not going to work. And so, you know, at some point, even the most, you know, stubborn, kind of like me when I needed that 2x4 across the head, you know, is going to kind of go, okay, you know, I get it, you know.
Well, John, we have about 15 minutes left. We've sort of touched on a lot of the things we plan to touch on, but are there any really important parts that maybe we want to make sure we sort of eke out that maybe I haven't asked you yet?
Let's see. I think that probably, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think probably the most important thing is that we recognize, you know, that this is a shift that's happening kind of whether we make it happen or not. And so I think a lot of people out there who are feeling like, you know, that overly, you know, great expectation that they need to be doing, you know, a certain kind of lifestyle and they need to be, you know, in a physical way really kind of doing all these practices and stuff, that can sometimes, you know, work against us because it can feed the self-judgment even more so. You know, it just becomes another battle. And so I think one of the messages that the Carol exemplify is their playfulness, their ease, their imperfection, their matter-of-factness, the pragmatic, you know, way that they approach life, because it's really much more about the energetic level of our soul and the subconscious mythic level than it is that we get psychologically dialed in and, you know, with beliefs and or physically dialed in. That's good too, but we've been doing it sort of upside down because that's the way we've been, you know, as Westerners have been living for so long, we've been sort of swimming upstream. And that's so hard, you know, to keep trying to change it, you know, through certain kinds of activism or, you know.
Well, and I'm hearing you maybe say, you know, it's sort of letting everything sort of lighten as opposed to maybe this intensity.
Right.
You know, it even makes me think about so many people are talking about, you know, how we're having to work harder for less. And it maybe even plays into that a little bit, that, this idea that it's okay that people need to have three jobs to live, maybe we shouldn't feel like that's okay, because where is the quality of life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is the fundamental shift in perception around what does, you know, what does signify quality of life and what is important to us. And the difficult thing is that we're still living in the world that doesn't fully support that. One example is, you know, people who think, you know, the truth is the most important thing. Always tell the truth and always. And it's like, yes, that's in the ideal world in the garden where there's no judgment and where, you know, everybody allows everyone else to have the diversity. It's like, that would be sweet. You know, everybody could read everybody's mind and the truth wouldn't bother anybody. But it's a major inconvenience when you're still sort of in the insane asylum to sort of stand up and go, hey, you're all insane. You
know? But I know the truth.
And be hung the next day, you know, or burned. And then what kind of work are you going to get done after that? So I do run into that, you know, and I've gone through that myself. It's sort of like sometimes when the movie's going really bad and everybody's crying and they're upset, you don't stand up in the theater and go, don't worry, everybody, it's just a movie, you know, because they paid $20 to cry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't want it. So the truth sometimes can be a little bit overrated in our world in that way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think it's also part of the lightening up, that we sort of can sit back, even if we kind of think we know some of this stuff, and still allow others to go through their drama,
their own journey.
Struggle.
Yeah, their own journey. Well, you know, it's interesting. I saw this email that you sent out about some sessions you're going to be doing, and what struck me about the email was that you were talking about how the universe works with us, our consciousness or our unconscious, even when we're asleep. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. You know, it's been really, really interesting as I continue to do my work and the emails, because I go down to L.A. and I do sessions once a month in San Francisco, and I do. But basically, I'd like to put in a little insight that's something that I've been picking up over the last month or whatever, as this shift is happening, and I'm getting to sit with people every day and do this work. And, you know, I recently was invited to, you know, be with the Hopi dancers who were at a friend's gallery in Santa Barbara, and that's when, you know, we sat down and we were sharing and we were talking about all, you know, what's going on in the world and their perspective, you know, which is very rich and very much like the Caro, you know, and they, you know, we started talking about this notion that as Westerners we're sort of used to the idea that we work hard all day long, whether it's just making money or we're in a spiritual practice or both. And, you know, you get to bedtime and you're just, I hope I can just sleep all night and get some rest and get up tomorrow and do my thing. And the sort of insight here is that, you know, that time, we are still, our soul, our energy body is still very conscious and oftentimes traveling about and doing things. I know as a shaman I've experienced doing sessions on people all night long and woke up and actually consciously remembered it. You know, we don't always remember our dreams and such like that and what journeys we took, but part of the fun of being here and sort of this coming back into our power as creators of our own experience is recognizing that we can use that time for that as well. That those of us who've been practicing, you know, manifesting our world in the waking state, it's there's a whole bunch of time on the other side, you know, the complete circle of time.
When our eyes are closed.
Yeah, when our eyes are closed and we're not doing the alpha state, but we can, before we go to sleep, go, okay, I'd like to get this done or do this or learn this or get an answer here or... And,
so how would somebody do that? I mean, would they just sort of pose a question before they go to sleep?
Yeah, it's a practice. You know, all these things are sort of relearning how to play an instrument, so to speak. And so you start out with something simple and you try it and you see what happens and you don't just get discouraged if nothing happens, you know. But you just sort of, you keep trying it. Yeah, you just set an intention before you go to sleep or you, you know, ask a question or... show me this, or I'd like to journey here and see if there are other planets with beings on them, or, you know, these, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
Or I'd like to contribute to the you know, clean air and clean water for the rest of the planet, like the monks are doing, isolating themselves in prayer all day long, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that time effectively if you practice setting that intent.
Okay.
Yeah, I hope that's clear. I don't know.
I think it is. I mean, because it's not a real specific thing, you know. I think it, because everybody's
right.
going to have a different idea about what intention they're going to set, for one thing,
yeah.
you know, and it might just work differently for different people. I think here is another example of you just have to take that leap of faith and trust and see what happens, you know.
Yeah. Enjoy the jungle. Enjoy the feminine. It's going to be full of surprises, and you won't
be
able to control all of them. So absolutely, just you know, go with courage.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, John, tell me and listeners more about some of the workshops that you have coming up.
Yeah, I'm getting into some interesting new things. A couple of friends of mine are musicians, and they've created some beautiful CDs of late. And so in Ojai on September 11th, I'm going to be with my friend Solvay and Will Chapman, and they're going to be doing their music, and I'm going to lead a journey, a destiny retrieval journey, an open space. And so we're kind of bringing in this energetic and mythic into the, you know, directly in a very, you know, shamanic specific way like this into the entertainment and the beauty of the music.
Now, does it have anything to do with 9/11, or is it just a coincidence of the date?
That's a coincidence,
if
there's such a thing. But basically, yeah, I don't think it was planned on that day. I'm not quite sure, but because I was invited by them to do this. The other one is on October 13th, which is my friend Chris Amadeo, who just produced this amazing album called, you know, Homo Luminous, which is, he's also gone through the training with the Caro and everything, so it's infused with a lot of this. So his first concert is down in San Juan Capistrano at the Coach House, kind of a big venue, and I'm going to get up there on stage and at least open space before the songs, and it's a very pop, folk music, you know, it's good just music, even if you have no idea what it's about, and his lyrics are brilliant, and the music's brilliant. But we're going to kind of start to bring this in, and one day we hope to have, and maybe even this concert, the Caro on stage doing one of their despacho ceremonies, like what happened one time with Alberto when he gave a talk and had them. So, you know, it's I've got things like that going on, and I've got my normal, I do every solstice and equinox, I do a talk here in Monterey at the Luminata Bookstore. And in terms of workshops, that's kind of what I do. But most of my work is you know, individual sessions and couples and sometimes groups.
And how can you, I probably asked you this before, but let me ask you again. I mean, can you help couples improve their relationship, or is it, is it physical healing or psychic healing?
It's really all of the above. I mean, the shamanic, at least my medicine, has a lot under the umbrella, so to speak. And so I do work, you know, with relationship issues. I work with physical, you know, things that have manifested physically. They all kind of go back to the core energetic patterns that we've...
And do you trance work, or what sort of modalities do you use? You know, guided journeys or...
A little bit of the guided journeys. I use stones. I have a mesa, 13 stones that have gone through my training with me with the Caro. That's really a part of their... We work with the stone people because I have a stone that's 2.2 billion years old. They're the oldest conscious beings on the planet, and they've gone through this training, so they're called kuyas now. They're like specialists. And so I place the stones on people, and the stones will miqui or digest heavy energies from the chakras that are, you know, patterns that are affecting, that are influencing people and having them create in their experience something they would prefer not to consciously. So we're really doing this clearing, and then I do, you know, soul retrieval and destiny retrieval, and I do this with, you know, couples or groups or individuals, and it's just, you know, a little bit of all of the above, some talking,
right.
some psychic, you know, tracking and understanding, but more importantly, the energetic work, and then I usually have people do a bit of their own mythic homework, like a mandala, like a Navajo sand painting, or a or an altar, or, you know, an ancestor altar if they need to, you know, no longer be influenced by their ancestors, or, you know, fire ceremony. So I kind of incorporate all of that and send people home with those tools they can use on their own so they don't need to call me again, really. But
right.
Do the mythic work, use that throughout their life, you know, the ritual, the ceremony, going
mm-hmm.
through the motions, and then some of these psychological tools, you might say psycho-spiritual things, like I teach meditations. I'm hoping to record some of those soon in some of my journeys, but basically, you know, giving people everything I can give them in one session to run with it and empower themselves to make this shift in a more graceful way, hopefully.
Well, you know, this has been fun, John, and I want to make sure I give your website again if I haven't already. It's dreamingintobeing.com, and you also have your book, which we didn't even really get a chance to talk about, Dreaming Your World Into Being. I guess the title sort of says it all, you know, sort of using these techniques you just described in
yeah.
your sessions. You can use those to help sort of create your own reality, I assume.
Yeah, you're either on a personal level or for the world, you know, it's that whole journey. So it's kind of a rich description of all of the stuff we've talked about. But I do have a lot of information on the website. It's pretty packed full of links and things that people can explore.
Okay. Well, I look forward to going and look at it myself. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to recommend you to the woman who puts together Gaia Fest every year in Santa Barbara. And, you know, I think you'd be a great... speaker to have maybe next year. So I'm going to put in a vote for you.
Oh, thank you. I'd be honored. I'm really happy to show up wherever I'm called and can be useful and do this work. So that's the whole thing.
Well, John, thank you so much. I see my second guest tonight she's on the switchboard waiting for me to say hello. So I just want to thank you so much for giving us all of this insight. It really has been interesting, and you validated so much for me. I hope you'll stay in touch, and if the Quero have any new information for us, I hope you'll email me, and maybe we can have you back on the show, and you can, you know, share what new information they might have with these prophecies.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate what you're doing again.
Oh, well, same to you, John. Thank you for your work in the world.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity archetype or ideals, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And you've been listening to John Rasmussen, a contemporary shaman, discussing working toward the return of the feminine and how the masculine warrior-dominant culture is just unsustainable. And, you know, that actually ties into our next guest tonight. Her name is Ricky Ott, and I'm so glad to have her on the show. Let me say hello to her and get her on the line with us, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about Ricky before we start our chat. So just one second here. Let me say hello, Ricky.
Hello, Karen.
Hi. Thank you so much for being on our show tonight. I really appreciate your time.
I should have come on a little bit earlier and listened to more of it.
Well, you know, you can always, when we get off the show in about an hour, the show's always on the archive, so you can listen. But it's funny how that actually does sort of tie in, to what's going on in the world. You know, what you and I are going to talk about, is really part of what my previous guest called the masculine warrior dominant cult that's sort of killing our world right now, like, you know, BP and big oil and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But, you know, I sort of gave a brief intro of you at the top of the hour. You're a PhD and a community activist. You used to be a salmon fisherman. I like that. That is so cute, a fisherman. And you have a degree in marine toxicology with a specialty in oil pollution. You lived through the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and you wrote a book as a result of that, actually two books, I think, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, and Not One Drop, Promises, Betrayal, and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. And you found three nonprofit organizations that deal with the lingering harm from these man-made environmental disasters. And I know you are on a campaign to abolish corporate personhood. So I want to try to, you know, I mean, it's all interconnected. So, you know, I'd love for you to share all of this with my listeners so that they understand this as well. So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the Exxon Valdez, how that all started you on this journey, I suppose?
I actually want to start with something I heard you say right off the bat, saying that the masculine warrior dominant type is killing the world, because what my understanding of this is, and I've actually been, I consider it a privilege to live in Alaska, where the native people were not put into reservations but into corporations. Reservations was a failed experiment by the time, you know, Alaska became a state, and then, anyway, I'm not saying corporations were any better, but the upshot of that is that the native people actually, we all live together, and there can be a lot of learning across cultures when people are open. And one of the things I learned from the native folks is that really what's killing the world is the imbalance in the masculine, mm-hmm. feminine. And that imbalance starts within us. And when we let it get out of control and express for the masculine warrior, that's where the trouble starts. And what we need to correct is and get back to is the balance.
Right, because we all have it within us to run amok, I guess.
I think that's it. We do all have an ability to run amok, and we got to, you know, watch that and watch it in each other as well.
Right.
But yeah, and my journey did not start there at all. It started by when I was a little kid growing up in Wisconsin, and, you know, here's Robin's dying, late 1960s, and went to my dad and said, "You do when you're 13 years old," and said, "Why?" And he explained about DET and gave me a book, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and I said, "Oh, that's it. I'm going to become a marine biologist," after I read her book, and pursued that path, and ultimately ended up in Alaska in 1985 with a PhD in marine toxicology. So I was pretty much science-oriented, and I wanted to be like Rachel Carson. I thought scientists would know everything, you know, when I was a little kid, and that they could explain everything. And what I came to learn is that actually there's many ways of knowing, and Western science is sort of the new kid on the block and the one that's kind of disrupting things.
Mm-hmm.
But having been a scientist, I can actually now kind of poke holes at where the weaknesses are in the thinking of it and explain to non-scientists why common sense actually factors in a lot. And that's coming in very handy down here in the Gulf right now. So basically, in Alaska, 1985, that was it. I brought a fishing boat and said, "Whoa, I'm just going to stay up here and fish." And 4 years later was Exxon Valdez. And, I mean, I remember flying over Prince William Sound and seeing this beautiful area just, you know, awash in oil and being kind of shell-shocked from all that, landing in Valdez. and just staring at the mountains and thinking, this thought just popped into my head, and it was, I know enough to make a difference. Do I care enough? And I don't know where I went, but somebody described it years later as an epiphany, and I actually had to go look that up. But it got very quiet where I was standing on the tarmac. There were airplanes, there were helicopters, there were trucks, there was traffic, and I didn't hear a thing. And I kind of played back my life and saw, I felt like a chess piece on an invisible board, just kind of being moved around, how this little kid from Wisconsin ends up at this place, at this time, with this knowledge that was really needed by at least the community where I was and other people as well. And I just thought, this is like, I don't know, this is, can't be coincidence. And in this great unfolding, I realized that even then, a person is given a choice, and the choice is, was I going to step up or was I going to step back? And I decided to step up. I decided that I loved the area, I loved the people, and where was I going to go? That this kind of thing wasn't happening. Just because it was in my face, you know, it didn't make any other place less vulnerable, really. So I decided to step up, and with that, I heard this, like, little noise, and I started focusing on the noise, and it was really the roar of a helicopter overhead that I completely didn't hear until I had made the commitment to step up. And that commitment has taken me on a very strange journey that I just didn't foresee at all, because basically what happened was the science only takes you so far. I mean, it really, really does. All this sort of left brain thinking. And when you isolate the problem-solving capabilities that we all possess as people to just the mental part of ourselves, and instead of the mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, I mean, holistic problem solving is about bringing our whole self to the table. But I didn't know that then. Just sort of extend that thinking to all the technological fixes that are being, sort of the left brain fixes that are being put forward for solving the climate crisis, the climate chaos.
You know, or even think about what they're doing in New Orleans with the levees, you know. I mean, it's sort of the same thing. It's sort of like a Band-Aid approach.
Yeah. And the cloud seeding, and I mean, just on and on and on. And it's like, actually, what we really need to do is acknowledge and respect the laws of nature and the fact that we live on a finite planet with finite resources. And we better figure it out. It's like kindergarten. Get along. Share. Right?
Yeah.
God. But anyway, so I kind of went flying at this with what my training had been, which was pretty heavy, you know, science, logic, all that. And the ecosystem collapsed after 4 years because all the young of the year, a lot of the young of the year didn't make it, and there was big holes in the ecosystem that showed up, from which we're still recovering, by the way. Still has not fully recovered in Prince William Sound. But that caused the economy to collapse, and then there were all these social problems that surfaced because lack of, you know, stress, financial stress causes huge dysfunction, individual, family, society, community, everything, manifested as domestic violence, suicides, divorces, substance abuse, all that. And finally, I think it was about 1996 when I literally just stopped to think, what else is out there? I mean, all the systems I've been trained in aren't working. The legal system, the political system. The political system was corrupt because you can corrupt, you know, people are greedy and people take money and then they are, you know, got to... I don't need to explain it. Everybody knows it, right? It's like, oh, man, don't bite the hand that feeds you. So political, scientific, legal, nothing I was trained in was working. And I literally was thinking, what else is out there? And my sister called. And she, I'll never forget this. She's calling and she's saying, so do you want to come with me to this training, esoteric training? It happened to be Lynn Andrews. And it was the farthest thing from my mind, I'll tell you that. And so in my dead silence, she goes, I bet you didn't even read that book I sent you. And I look over at the bookshelf, and there's the book that she sent me about, you know, Lynn Andrews something or other. And I'm hearing my sister talk, but part of me is thinking, that's odd. I just asked what else is out there, and my sister called. You know, so I decided to go for it. And I just said yes. And my sister was like, what? Really? So we ended up at this training, and I actually did this. It was just a long weekend. And I went with a really open mind because I decided, you know, my scientific mind is pretty locked down, solid, tight logic. And there's no getting around it, right? So it was a conscious decision on my part to just go with an open mind and just pretend like you're stepping onto another planet. I mean, as far as I was concerned, California was another planet. just observe. You know, you're a scientist. Just observe. No bias. So I will say, just as a footnote to all this, that we three children were all raised as Christian Scientists. And there were some things that I stuck into a weird file when I was a kid because they didn't make sense in the society that I was being raised in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just hearing that even the family doctor said, well, chalk one up for your side of the family, meaning my mother's Christian Science side, versus my father's Lutheran side. But anyway, it was just like, okay, that's weird. Too weird for me to explain. I'll just, you know, stick it in this file. So here I am seeing more sort of weird, right? And I decided to pursue it further because I decided if these things that I was seeing and experiencing sort of in an altered state without taking any drugs, what if that power could be, you know, you could learn to flow with it and go with it and to bring good. Mm-hmm. That was the
right.
To bring healing. And I went and I took what I actually highly recommend is the Institute of Noetic Sciences Nine Gates program.
Mm-hmm.
And so is in California. Gay Luce is the founder of that program. For me, it was just the right thing. It brought in teachings from around the world, literally, Sufi, Hindu, African, Druid. I mean, just a number of different ways of looking at the world and sorting out information and creating a reality. And
right.
I came to understand that reality really is a social construct. I mean, it really is. And some societies say this is taboo, and some societies, you know, don't even have a word for paranormal. It's all normal, right?
Right.
And so I began to see that, oh, my goodness, I was raised in a box. And the box is culture, you know, and the culture that I'm in. And if you, you know, get up your nerve and kind of wrestle around and open the box and poke your head out, you'll see there's all these other boxes, and they're all labeled different cultures, right?
Right.
What if you kind of went on this little trip and took a look at these different cultures and started accepting, again, open mind, no bias, no prejudices, other people's worldviews, other people's constructs of reality? Just how would things look? And what would healing look like, and what would punishment or retribution look like, or mitigation, or, you know, what, all these things. And in kind of looking at the world that way from Cordova, that brings a whole nother level to problem solving. And ultimately where we got in Cordova, which is my sort of my crucible, was that the community itself began to ask, how did corporations, well, okay, so two things. One was we needed to diversify our economy because it flat collapsed. So we had our October 2008 back in August 1993. And so hold the second question for a second. So the first question really was, how do we diversify? Well, we went around and around, but finally came up with a pretty simple exercise. And since it was all collapsed, part of the town was saying, well, since it's all collapsed, can we fix it in a way that matches our values and that will bring in a, you know, a, that businesses that are, that, well, match our values. I mean, that's the best way to say it. So
right.
Then we had to figure out, and we'll protect what we love. Well, so then we had to figure out what was our vision. I mean, what were our values? And we came up with a very simple exercise that I've now done in 30 states over the past 3 years. And it's posted on my website, rickyott.com. But basically, you just give people 3 minutes to answer a question, well, what do you like? What do you like about your community? And when you only give people 3 minutes, they come up with some very basic human things that we share, actually by just by virtue of being human.
Right.
And even if you go down to fifth grade kids, I mean, if you do this with fifth grade, I've done this fifth grade all the way through university and out general public. Little fifth graders say things like best friend, my mommy and daddy, my home, my pet or dog, or cat or whatever. They'll always say ocean, mountains, air, wherever they are, surfboard, snowboard, skateboard, whatever flavor
right.
of the country. But the point in this exercise, and adults say things like living wages, retirement security, you know, affordable homes, health care, but also clean water and air and healthy food. Kids
mm-hmm.
say can't. But the point is, not everything that's listed has a dollar value on it.
Right.
I mean, best, do you put a dollar value on best friends? You know, no. So people start to see that there's social wealth, environmental wealth, and economic wealth.
Right.
Okay, so you have three balls that we're now trying to juggle. Can we build an economy that keeps all the balls in the air, right? Instead of letting, like the way we do it now, the economy ball's always got to be in the air. And the social wealth and the environmental wealth can fall flat. I mean,
right.
look what's happening in the Gulf. And
right.
it's all about getting the casinos back running and making sure tourists come to the beaches and forget the fact that, you know, 40% of the population in the Gulf is hacking and sneezing and wheezing and having skin rashes and, oh, no, it can't be connected to this. Don't be ridiculous. We need people down here. The ocean's fine for swimming in. Well, you know, it's not. Those two balls need to be valued, respected, and put back up in the air here. So this is all, of course, now is being taught as triple bottom line accounting or full cost accounting where you don't, as a corporation, say, ooh, boy, you know, that gas tank and that Pinto, that's going to be trouble. But, you know, it's only going to cost us so much, and we can make millions more by selling it before we get caught. So let's just go ahead and kill a few people, you know, big deal. You know, that's an externality. You can't do that. So, what's full cost accounting? So, then comes the next simple question. Well, this is pretty obvious that we need, and the Native people call it, you know, this is a seven generation thing, sustainable. You know, think about the words. I introduced the concept of sustainable development in Cordova, and immediately it was challenged. Why do we want development to be sustainable? Don't we want our communities to be sustainable? So I was like, oh, yeah. So think about the words we're using. And when we went at it that way, it was like, these are human values, and they need to count in a democracy. And that's when we ran into our second little problem. So we really didn't seem to have a functioning democracy. And that's when people began to ask the question, so how did corporations get this big, that they can manipulate the legal system? By now, we've been fighting a lawsuit 17, 18 years over claims that Exxon said, show us, you know, bring us your reasonable claims. We'll compensate you. Well, that turned out to be a one-way ticket to court. That's when I did a little bit of research and discovered that democracy has been hijacked by the corporations very cleverly. There's two ways to amend the U.S. Constitution: through the front door, which is how we write laws, how we've done it 27 times, we the people, through Congress, and then through the back door, through the Supreme Court, which...
Well, that's what they just did, right? With the Roberts Court, made corporations people, so they can donate as much as they want to campaigns. So, I mean, literally, foreign countries could be affecting, you know, our legislation.
I hope you're sitting down, because actually, the court decided that corporations were persons equal to things with belly buttons back in 1886. During the robber baron era.
Okay.
1886. And all the Roberts Court did was take precedent established, created, made up out of thin air by previous Supreme Court judges. So precedent one, corporations are people. Precedent two, money is speech. That was 1976. Therefore, if we limit money, were limiting speech, and we will create a disadvantaged class, meaning these Fortune 500 corporations,
uh-huh.
And therefore we have to open up corporate treasuries for unlimited spending in our election process. That's what the Supreme Court just recently did in January of this year.
Right, right.
So...
Well, Ricky, is there? I mean, I know you're trying to get that changed. I mean, where are things at with that? What is the likelihood that we stand a chance to, you know, to roll this back?
I'd say very good. And the reason I say that is because we're not under a time clock here. And what's happening is this is about deep social change. This is not about going to Congress and saying, can you please fix this? It's broken, because Congress is broken. And just to make clear, what the Roberts Court did was it broke all three, it disabled all three branches of our democracy and disabled the democracy in the process. So now corporate-bought politicians will be passing corporate-written laws that will be interpreted by court-elected judges, it's not going to work. It's just not going to work anymore. So we got two choices when you want to do social change. You either go to the existing power structures, the universities, the Congress, and you say, please, can you make things a little less bad? Or you do what the abolitionists and the suffragists did. You go and you start co-creating the society that we want to live in. And you build such a powerful vision with such passion and putting it into practice that eventually you sway, you pull the institutions of power to come into your court. And that's what we're trying to do. So when people say, who are you working with in Congress? Nobody. It's too premature to go there. What I am working with is community by community, building this grassroots movement. And if you go to movetoamend.org, you'll see sort of the scope and extent of it. And one of the places where we were missing in organization was in the Deep South. And, in fact, I had this hilarious conversation with a Berkeley professor in February of this year saying, well, what are you doing to organize in the Deep South? And I didn't have an answer then. And I wish I had a do-over of that conversation now, because, I mean, I've literally been down in the Gulf since May 3rd, first giving people the knowledge that they needed to deal with the immediate disaster at hand. So knowledge on the oil spill, long-term effects on the ecosystem effects, effects on people, effects on community. Heads up, this is what's going to happen next. And as one person said, the last community, how's that? You know, everything you said has come to pass. And it's like, that's because we already went through it once in Alaska. And, you know, there's only so many ways this thing can go. And it's, BP is playing with the same songbook here. So, so now, because of the coaching and stuff, people are, and I will say, because of BP's extreme aggression, 21 years difference, BP, the corporations are a lot more aggressive and the government is a lot more passive. I mean, I'm literally witnessing the militarization of America in these 21 years. And it is not good.
Now, what do you mean when you say the militarization? I mean that they're literally using the our military structure to help support the corporate interest?
Absolutely. There's sheriffs, there's Coast Guard, everything is, all these public agencies are being used as public shields for BP. It's BP calling the shots, keeping the media, First Amendment right, forget it.
Yeah.
Off the beaches, out of the air, out of the municipal waste dumps where they're piling all this carcasses and God knows what else. It's police working off duty in their uniforms for BP. It's unbelievable. There's a website, it's a blog spot actually, BP oilslick.blogspot.com. That's got a lot of video footage up on it, including documentation of police state here harassing new reporters, people with cameras.
Well, the media blackout has been incredible. I mean, for these hundreds of miles, or it might even be thousands of miles of coast, for us not seeing any more than we've seen, I mean, anybody in their right mind had to know that there's a huge media blackout.
Well, and so, I mean, this, I believe, is the military corporate, you know, complex here.
Okay.
In control. And, I mean, who uses half of the oil that the U.S. consumes? The military.
Well,
right?
And I think BP provides a lot of the military's oil, too, I think I heard.
Well, I'm actually not sure of that. I haven't broken it down that far. But before everybody...
How did the community respond, though, Ricky? Because I know, I mean, I used to live in New Orleans, and I know the oil and gas companies, so many people rely on them for their livelihood. You know, they're sort of indoctrinated to bow at the feet of big oil. Were they open to your suggestions about how to fight them? I mean, or are they just sort of going quietly into the night?
Okay, so... I've been mostly organizing down on the coast, so coast from Terrebonne, so west of Barataria, midway, halfway across Louisiana, all the way over into, I've been down as far as Everglades City in Florida, so you can't get much farther south than that, and back and forth across the Gulf, and people about mid-June started to ask, there's something really wrong here because people were getting forced off their own beaches or public beaches if they had a camera by Coast Guard, by police, if they saw a dead dolphin. You know, they go over and you're going to get arrested if you touch that. Excuse me? So people were starting to ask, how is this happening in America? What is going on? And so I was able to bring sort of the corporate story into this, and I would just ask, so does anybody here think the federal government's in charge, and not a single person would ever raise their hand, whether it was audiences of, you know, 50 people or 1,500 people. And that has now evolved. August was the worst month. So I'm getting to answer your question, okay, but it's just going to take a little bit here. So August was the worst month because that's when the well is capped. And August 2nd, I believe, was when that pie chart came out, the federal government story, BP story, 75-80% of the oil is miraculously gone. And this was not the people's experience at all. Oil has been washing into beaches and bays and bayous. People are getting sick because there's a mass dumping of dispersant spraying going on now to make the oil go away so that it matches the official story. I spent the entire first week of August dealing with people in different states trying to get them to emergency rooms because of puking and peeing brown, which is associated with this solvent exposure in the dispersant. I mean, it was a nightmare. Fish kills, everything. And so after a month of, we've got people in different communities across the Gulf. Believe me when I said, you know, we're going to have to figure this out ourselves. Don't sit around. Okay, plan A is waiting for the federal agencies and the federal government and BP to take care of us. Plan B is to come up with your own plan. So if you have to come up with plan B, what exactly would you do? And people were like, well, we'd want our own air quality and water quality samplers. Okay, let's go get them. And then how do you, we're sick. What are the proper diagnoses? Well, you need blood panel work. Okay, let's get them. And so we have air quality, water quality, and blood work showing that there's oil. It's a problem. It's in people's blood, oil metabolite. We have a whole month of this. And people are now asking me, what do we do now? I mean, we're like in a rut where we've got one story, and the government just keeps saying, it's like the big lie, you know, you just repeat it big enough and long enough, everybody will believe it.
Well, could you give it to any of the media outlets, you know, so that the media outlets, or are they all just bought off? I mean, like MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, or Keith Olbermann, you know, I'm sure they would give the real story.
Post it on my website. Anybody can take it. I got the video. I got the photographs. I've got all kinds of stuff on there. On an open letter to EPA, that was the latest thing I did. I don't know. I guess it's been last Friday now. I can't even remember. But pretty recently. And so the point here is, though, that the federal government and BP have decided what the end game is. The end game is this is over, and it's going to be back to business as usual, more oil to feed our insatiable appetite, which means more unsustainable living, right? And so I just started talking last week in communities because this is now what people are asking me, what's next? We need to change the end game. And so we sat in a circle, literally in a circle, in Port Sulphur, with African-American people, Native American people, Nigerian people, people from Alaska who have come down to visit, the Inupiat people. And because up in Alaska, you know, we kind of got the same problem. We're kind of a sacrifice zone for the nation's domestic oil appetite. And the question was, people said we need jobs. Everybody agreed we need jobs. And then it occurred to somebody, well, why do we have to accept dirty jobs? Why can't we insist on clean jobs? So this now gets back to the triple bottom line stuff, right?
Right.
We want to have a job, match our values.
Right.
And so the issue was put out there, wouldn't it be something if the sacrifice areas, the sacrifice zones, globally and nationally, Nigeria, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alaska, actually intentionally and very seriously with the coastal communities in particular who have much greater interest in lifestyle choices and cultural choices, just said enough. And we started framing what the future would look like and bringing in the clean jobs and not being passive anymore. I mean, that is starting to occur to people. I'm literally seeing the South rise, and now I fully understand why that question was asked to me back in Berkeley. It seems like in another lifetime, what are you doing to organize in the Deep South? And, you know, now I'm seeing the Deep South starting to rise, and I have actually committed to staying down here for a full year to just keep up this organizing. I think this is really a critical juncture down here of sustainability, democracy, and justice, climate justice,
right
here at this intersection. And, you know, I intend to bring and help people bring their whole self to it. This isn't about finger-pointing, oh, BP is bad, oh, the federal government's making bad choices. This is about, no, what are we going to do in our communities to keep our children healthy, ourselves healthy, and be able to, you know, live the, teach, I've run into sixth-generation fishermen down here, Cajun fishermen, be able to perpetuate our lifestyle choices, our cultural choices, and have the economy support our choices rather than having us, you know, sacrificing everything to build somebody else's economy.
Well, or are you finding that they're getting on board? Because I know that's a pretty conservative, almost sort of backward way of life there. I mean, I would imagine, well, you know, I don't know. I can just imagine their reaction to these, quote, indigenous-looking people, you know, making, you know, suggestions about how to change their life. You know, I mean, you know, my experience living down there is that they're not very open-minded. You know, they've been living in these narrow little boxes for so long, you know. But has this disaster forced them into being more open?
That's what I'm saying. The disaster has, as some people have said, it's like a veil has been ripped off my face. And it's actually the people, the socially vulnerable people, the ones who were left behind in Katrina, the Vietnamese Americans, the African Americans, the Native Americans, the Cajun folks, who are, I'm not pushing them. They're seeing it. And just because I've already done this once in Cordova, I'm able to say, well, here's a tool to use, you know. We can do this visioning exercise. I'm talking about we need to take our government back. I've had Tea Party people erupt out of the audience, come rushing up to me and say, what can we do to help? We can network you with 70 other Tea Parties in the state of Florida. I about fell over. I'm not kidding.
Well, you know, I always kept thinking that if the Tea Partiers could just learn who the real enemy was and we could, you know, we could team up, then maybe something might happen for the good, you know. Well, Ricky, let me ask you this. This seems like, okay, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this seems like not something that could happen very quickly. I mean, this seems like years and years it would take to actually do something like this. Is that an accurate assessment, or can this be done relatively quickly?
I think what we're talking about here is doing some serious time folding and not giving ourselves time constraints. But just saying, setting the intent, aligning the, you know, the spirit with it, and just saying this is what needs to happen, and then get out of the way. And because I think things are going to happen faster than we could have predicted once people get aligned on, you know, setting their intent instead of just sitting back passively, but saying, you know, this is what we want to happen. I see great strides being made by the Norwegians, by the Germans in wind power, huge strides in a very short time. I see that the last sort of frontier here for wind power is offshore. I see oil rigs that could be turned into wind farms. I mean, come on. We're talking about replacing one with another. And I don't think we need to handicap ourselves by saying, are we going to make it in time? I just think we need to keep working together as a people. You know, what people are saying down here is one people, one voice, one Gulf, you know, one future. Let's go for it.
Well, you know what I find interesting, and I don't know, for whatever, you know, 2 cents this is worth, it felt like to me when Katrina happened, it was almost as if New Orleans was sacrificed to expose a lot of sins. And it's almost like you called it a sacrifice area or something. And it makes sense to me. It's almost like this whole Gulf area in this incident, it's almost like could this disaster have happened to be the catalyst for real change? It's almost as if their sacrifice may make the change possible. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
that's
it's,
what I'm that's what I saw, and that's one of the reasons I decided to come down here on in May 3rd. I came down with a one-way ticket. I mean, I knew that people were going to – what I hoped was that by sharing some of the lessons from Alaska, that we could prevent some of the mistakes that we made, because we made mistakes. I mean, you know, we got – I'm still dealing with sick people from the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and that was 21 years ago. And even though people are sick down here, like lots of them, the point is – they know why they're sick, and we didn't know that in Alaska for another 10 years. And what I see happening here is, like, if you step back and look at globalization, which is the ultimate corporate power grab, right, what it's really pits the rich North nations against the poor South. That's where we've sort of externalized the cost of our lifestyle, you know, like in the United States, you know. If everybody lived like us, we'd need 5 planets, right?
Right.
So we've externalized the cost of that to the poor South. Now, zoom in a little bit and just look at our nation as a whole. Where have we sort of externalized the cost of sustaining our lifestyle in our own nation? We've externalized the cost to the socially vulnerable areas. Appalachia, with the mountaintop removal, entire Gulf region with the petrochemical industry then supplying 30% of our nation's domestic oil, and Alaska. And so there's this pattern of pushing off, you know, the risks to areas that are socially vulnerable, politically weak, not able to defend themselves. And what I'm seeing here in the Gulf is the people are waking up from a very long slumber, and they're saying, we're losing our land and our marshes and bayous because of subsidence from the oil extraction and gas extraction, and also from erosion from the Mississippi not being able to replenish the land that's being lost, erosion control by the dams. We're losing our health because of the petrochemical industry. I mean, Cancer Alley is Louisiana to Baton Rouge. And it's accepted. I've talked to people who it's normal to have 3 or 4 different forms of cancer. This is not normal. This is too much of a sacrifice.
Well, Ricky, how are the people getting sick? I mean, are they is the oil in the water supply, or how are they ingesting the oil in the dispersants?
The oil is in the oil. The dispersant is like a delivery mechanism for the oil. It broke the oil up. It's in little droplets. Those droplets are being pulled up into the air. I've seen, in fact, on that the BP oil slick .blogspot.com, there's pictures of the plane, and I've been on a plane where the leading edge of it just gets this oily, reddish-coated film, and it's in the air. It's
so they're breathing it in. They're breathing it in then.
Yes, and they're also in the water, and it's skin contact with these horrible, horrible rashes that look like MRSA. I mean, it's just horrible.
Well, I don't know that anybody I know believes that the seafood is safe. And, I mean, I know I won't even buy seafood in the grocery store because I'm afraid they won't tell me really even where it's from. I mean, is that really, I mean, this idea that the seafood is safe, come back to the beaches, eat the fish, eat the shrimp, that's probably just government propaganda too, right?
Yes, it is. The fishermen here, I have worked with fishermen from 4 different states in big meetings, and there's consensus letters that have been posted, and I'm staying in a fisherman's backyard, and one of the big things we're worried about, and I've worked on repeatedly, is seafood safety, and that was the whole reason for that open letter to EPA that just got posted on wikiat.com, and because EPA, we were at this meeting, there were 20 fishermen at this meeting with the 5 federal agencies, FDA, EPA, NOAA, and on and on, and they have this assumption that there's no visible oil for 30 days, and this last dispersant spraying was July 19th. And I said, what if we can disprove both of those assumptions? The fish don't live at the surface. The fish live in the water column. We can prove there's subsurface oil. There's oil in plumes. There's oil anchors on the bottom. And we can prove that dispersant spraying is still ongoing. Then that shoots your assumptions. Will you close the fisheries? Because we don't think they're safe. The fishermen are not eating their own fish. They're not catching fish. I mean, heck, these are the guys that know the most. I mean, they're getting false bottoms on their depth sounders because there's a plume at 12 feet when the bottom is supposed to be at 40 feet. And they can put an absorbent pad down, lower it in a sparkly clear ocean. There's videos of this up on BrickYacht.com. Lower it, pull it back up from 12 feet, and it'll have oil on it. That's where
the oil. So is the, I mean, is there still oil leaking into the Gulf?
Not, I don't think at this moment from the BP wellhead blowout. So that's not the issue. The issue is that there's 75% of the oil that was leaked is still around in some form or other, and it's coming in everywhere, and it's in the sediment, and it's in the marshes, and it's in the sand, and it's tar balls rolling onto beaches, and it is not safe. It
and
is not.
One of these hurricanes hit, and then it's really going to probably even go further inland, right?
It's in the rain. We've got rainwater samples, yes. And so I'm not breathing in all clear until the hurricane season is over with, and then we'll see what the thing is.
Well, Ricky, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left here. How do you want to use that time to the best possible good? I mean, what more information? I mean, what don't we know that we haven't talked about already that they're trying to keep from the public? Or what can listeners do to support this effort? What's the most important thing to say?
What it's going to take for social change, I mean, I think this is it. I think this is our worst oil spill as a nation, and we have to realize as a people that it's not over. So please don't believe the media. What we need is the same level of national solidarity that we saw after the Santa Barbara spill in 1969 that pushed through the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, created the Environmental Protection Agency. That is the level of solidarity that we need to make use of this oil disaster to get the energy legislation that we need. And I'm actually glad that the energy legislation is going to be toast because it was yet another compromise that wouldn't have worked. We need to get the power of the pen back. We, the people, need to get the power of the pen back so that we're writing the legislation, not the oil industry. So there's two things that people need to do. People need to create the change in their own communities. And I'm talking about teaching the children about transition towns, about sustainability, about have your town, attend town meetings, have your town become a transition town, have your town become sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, the Mayor's Accord, the Mayor's. There's over 1,000 cities across the United States. In this lack of federal leadership, this void of international and national leadership, we the people have the power to create the communities we want. I'm talking about a grassroots revolution. I'm talking about the social shift starting from the grassroots in our communities. And eventually we will pull the power structure with us. Take a look at two things. Take a look at what you can do in your own community to start the shift towards a post-oil economy, towards a post-mega industrial economy. Start that shift, but then also join the democracy movement. Move to amend. How do we get our democracy back? So it's once again of, for, and by we the people, as opposed to the corporations. And then finally, we're working hard on stuff in the Gulf here. We're about to have a petition to EPA on the whole dispersant debacle. So that'll be coming out. Another big push will be to get community public health clinics across the Gulf funded. So they're like free clinics, and then get the training down here for medical doctors. So please pay attention. BridgeTheGulfProject.org is a website where all five states are dumping information. RickyOtt.com, of course, I'm going to be down here helping. But again, I'm helping. This is somebody else's backyard.
Right.
But in a way, it's all of our backyard. I mean, when in California you say, no drilling off our coast in California, that means more drilling in Louisiana where people are less able to defend themselves.
Right.
So let's be conscious of that and not lose sight of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. How can we help the transition there? Because if we can transition here in the Deep South, then I think we've got these big corporations on the run.
Last question for you, Ricky. The local governments, the mayors, the city council people, are they helping you or are they just being bought off?
It depends on where you're at, but I tell you what, a lot of these, where I am here in, the Jefferson Parish.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson Parish is actually starting two of the first community healthcare clinics as satellites in Grand Isle and Lafitte, where it's going to be focused on chemical illnesses and focused ahead for the next 20 years. And we want to try to replicate these across the Gulf. So, at first there was a push that, never mind all you people arguing that there's a problem and never mind that you're sick. We want to bring the businesses back and bring the tourists back. But now that the school children are back in school and a lot of them are being sent home because they're sick, the mayors are starting to say, wait a second, maybe we messed up here. So there's a lot of, wait a minute right now.
Yeah.
And I hope to use this to turn it around to see that we can't bury this. We need to deal with it.
Right, absolutely. Well, Ricky, thank goodness they have you. Really, seriously. I'm sure you are a guiding light for them, and I'm glad that moment you had your epiphany and you stepped up and you saw, how useful you could be. And it sounds like you're doing incredible work. There are other people talking about transition towns and stuff like that, and taking back the government. Wow. Grassroots movements, we really have become so complacent, so apathetic. Really, if we really care about the future, we just, we all have to become activists. We just can't sit back anymore.
I think what we need to ask is the same thing that I asked myself. I didn't ask myself. It popped into my head, literally, March 24th, 1989. We as a people know enough to make a difference. We know the climate crisis. We know what the solutions are. It's going to take a little bit of hard work to get there. Do we as a people care enough? And I think each of us individually needs to ask that. I know enough. Do I care enough? And then we need to figure out where can we lend our hand to solving this big mess we've got ourselves into.
Right.
It's going to come from the bottom up. It's not going to come from the top down. That much I'm convinced with.
Well, and I think everything we've seen, I think it's really exposing this idea of what you said, the government is just in the pocket of the corporations, and it really is broken. It really is broken. Well, we're about to go off the air here. There's only 2 minutes, and we're going to stop streaming. So I'm going to have to say thank you and good night and mention your website again, rickiott.com, and that's rickiott.com. Please, listeners, go take a look at her website. Also, movetoamend.org and bridgethegulfproject.org. I'm sure lots of information there. And Ricky, you're just incredible. Thank you so much for the work you're doing in the world. It's so important.
You're so welcome. Let's all just walk in balance now. That's the key, with a little bit of humor, lots of humor.
There you go. I mean, and honestly, this show was so in sync with the first guest. It's really uncanny. And I just hope there's some way you can get the attention of Rachel Maddow, because she's been down there, and she's not afraid to speak truth to power, and I think she would help you if there's a way you could get her attention.
I've been on her show, so I will make sure she gets that open letter to EP. I'll just make sure she gets it.
Well, thank you, Ricky. Thank you very much, and good night. And if there's any new developments, please let me know, and I'm happy to have you back on the show anytime.
Okay, Karen. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Well, listeners, we only have about a minute left here, so I am going to close with an evening prayer that is so appropriate, and it goes like this. Now I lay me down to sleep. Please help me learn my world to keep, to guard the air and skies of blue, the oceans, lakes, and rivers too. Save the mighty forest lands, the plains, the shores, the desert sands. Protect all creatures wild and free, in air, on land, and in the sea. Good night, listeners, and I hope you'll tune in next Wednesday.